This week we have a freeform chat about our characters, our games, and our story developments. We'll get into the gods and religion and how to kill the Xanatha. Welcome to We Speak Common.
Benjamin.
Oh, Joseph. Hello.
Hello.
I'm all right.
Weird, isn't it?
That was a bit weird. That was very weird. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very well. Very well. Well, better than you.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Don't rub it in. Oh, mate.
So you've got it. You've got the Peroni.
Well, we don't know that yet. I mean, I might have it.
the not test. Really laughing, Matt, is it?
Yeah. No, it's really not. But what you can see, anything you can do in in a moment like this. No, I'm all right. I haven't been sleeping because I've been sweating, bloody fevers and all that. But yeah, I don't recommend having the test. It's not nice, mate. It's not nice.
Well, if you go down, I'll have to just carry on the show myself, won't I?
Mate.
It would just be me talking to me.
That sounds wonderful. I'm glad I won't be around to experience it.
That's a bit grim.
On a serious note, I'm okay. I'm all right. So don't worry about it.
Dear, well, we, you know, speaking of Dungeons & Dragons.
What a great segue.
Thanks. Look, guys, this isn't going to be our best one. I'm going to lie to you. Oh. It's got one of those vibes of not being our best one.
Yeah.
But, look, no, but what I was going to say is we played yesterday in your game, Dragon Heist. And I will have to point out, Ben, I reread that little letter you sent me.
Mm-hmm.
Just for people who don't know, the character got a letter from his brother, who lives far away. It was a bit of correspondence, etc. But Ben sent me the letter in message form. And I must say, Ben, it was very immersive because obviously it's written from the perspective of like a 12, 13-year-old kid or whatever. And it felt that way, you know? I felt the sort of excitable nature of the kid in the letter.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
It was very immersive. I was like, whoa, I'm transported to this world right now. So, I don't know why that hit me like that when, you know, the game doesn't normally feel quite like that, you know, but just for some reason that one little thing just really, really worked for me.
Yeah, I know what you mean, because immersion's something that I aim for all the time. That's like my benchmark is that I want there to be parts every now and then where players feel like they are experiencing an actual thing. So you know, we had Fleets Week Festival a couple of sessions ago, and we'd been building up for it for a while, and I'd planned this big description of the parade and the music and you know, how it was going to be and all the little mini games, and a couple of the guys were like, wow, yeah, it really felt like we were at a parade. And I was like, great, mission achieved. And you can't get that every single session because that's just too much of a standard to put, but I was waiting and like eagerly awaiting to send you this letter because it was set up so many games ago.
Really?
It was I don't even know how many sessions this was, but you originally sent it when we were playing the starter set, and then obviously I took over and I,
yeah, so like, just so to inform people, I just gave a little goblin mate of mine, Droop, his name was, I believe.
Yeah, Droop.
I gave him this letter and just said, hey, could you like go a few hundred miles up the road and deliver it? I didn't think he was going to make it, to be honest, or that he would bother, but, you know, turned out to be a loyal little goblin friend.
Well, that's the thing, because when you did it, James was running the game at that point, and we're sort of doing this together, and that's been like the thing that's made this campaign so special, I think, the intertwining of the different sort of settings. Like, my domain is Waterdeep in that area of the Sword Coast, and he's dealing with like Baldur's Gate in that area and the Moonshares and stuff, so we sort of cross over and it's a lot of fun. It makes it a very interesting shared world. And when you sent it, I remember him saying to me like, god, I don't know what to do with that. And I said, don't worry, let me deal with it, because it's going to take him a long time, because you never told us where your family was from. So
no, I just said like Sword Coast, south. Mm. You know, that was like it.
So I did some research. I looked into you know, possible good areas, and I found a nice little village. It doesn't have too much going on. That's a little off ways down the Delabrimri, the river. That's not at the coast. It's just a little bit further in. Just so it's sort of perfect for sort of nice quiet area, but far enough away that, you know, if something blows up in the city, you know, it's a respectable place to raise a family. And then I was like, well, you know, shit, that's gonna take a long time. But then, as we've said before, I think when we were talking about the old dragon experience, that payoff for that wait, it can be really good. So I left it a long time, long old time, and I'm happy with it. I'm glad that your little smile when you were reading it was enough for me to feel like, yeah, okay, that's paid off.
Yeah, well, I'd pretty much forgotten about it at that point, so it was like nostalgic, you know, of our previous campaign.
There's little bits in there as well. That sort of give you an idea of the area, because I know I haven't actually told you where it is. So if you ever want to know, just have a chat with me. But like, I think there's a bit where he mentions catching fish, and I actually went and checked what kind of fish he could catch in that river that runs by the hometown, and whereabouts they would be, and what breed they were. So it's spot on.
This is testament to what we were saying, well, what we always say on this show, especially when it comes to planning and things like that, because that's what we get asked about all the time, is that whilst those extraneous details are not necessary, when you do go to those lengths, now from my point of view when reading that letter, I don't really know much about Forgotten Realms at all. It's not really a game. I never run games, and I don't really plan to as such, so I've never learned much about it other than just being a player, right, in my own little space within that world.
Yeah.
So all those names and everything you could have just made up, right? They could have been your additions to the world. I would have known that, or, you know, you could have just pulled them out your ass, essentially. But even though you went to all those details, even though I didn't know it was part of the lore and very well researched, you can still feel it.
Yeah.
In the letter, you know when something's been well planned. You can just feel it. You know, just watch The Rise of Skywalker and you'll get a sort of an opposite effect of that. You know, you'll get... you know, so it just felt that, and that's why it worked. You know, you can, when something is paid off like that, but in very meticulous detail, very well paced as well, because like I say, it was like just at the point where I forgot about it, and then boom, it's like a nice reminder. It was connected to our old campaign, so that was like a sort of blast from the past as well, because that was months ago now. So it all just worked very harmoniously. And also, it was quite nice as you pulled characteristics that I'd roughly detailed of characters in my backstory and just sprinkled them into the letter with behavior that felt congruent to them and what they would actually do. So you spoke about Kauri, my character. You spoke about his dad. Obviously, the brother was writing the letter. You spoke about other family members, sisters, mums, what, you know, whoever. But they all just matched well, you know. There was never a point where I felt like, oh, that doesn't quite line up to what I wrote. Not that it would even really matter, but it just matched, you know, and that just felt good to me as a player. It felt like you understood my character's backstory and where they'd come from. You'd obviously spent some time in that headspace to get familiarized with what I was basically putting down on the table, and then you've grown on that, which I think is... it's pretty key, really. Sometimes, you know, you can subvert an expectation and tweak something, so it's a bit of a surprise to a character. That's kind of high risk, and oftentimes doesn't pay off unless you do it extremely well. But I think that's sort of a lesson, really. When you're looking at a player's backstory and you want to incorporate some stuff, you can generally tell by how they've written it or what they've told you about it, what are the aspects are important to them about that story and what they want to keep. Like, for instance, with my paladin Galahad, his backstory, I think some of the key components there were that his brother was a good guy. He's always going to be a good guy. He's always described as being of, you know, a really good soul, basically. You know? So if you then went, oh, I've resurrected him and he is a demon boy.
Yeah, he's evil.
He's always been a demon boy. And I'd be like, okay. I mean, not really what I said, but okay.
Yeah.
But that's an important characteristic. But then other bits, you can kind of change a bit. So, like, the stepmom character there is not necessarily exactly how I envisioned her in my head, but the alternative was just as good. And it wasn't something I had my heart set on. So it's important, I think, to keep, or just ask the player, like, what are the key touchstones of this story that can't really be messed with? Or if you're unsure of it, just ask your player, okay, I've got this character here. Clearly, he might come up in the story later on. It's from your backstory, your long-lost, you know, lover or whatever. What's the key personality traits about this person that really are sort of immutable and can't be changed?
Yeah.
Because that just gives you a good framework. And generally, that will still leave you with a lot of room for creativity to surprise the player. Oftentimes, if I'm a player and I write a backstory, I don't want to give too much detail because I want to give the DM room to surprise me later on. I don't want to write a quest for myself later on and then also write the outcome in that backstory.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise you might as well just write a book.
Yeah, where's the game in that? Yeah, where's the development? I think a good example of the adverting expectations with the Galahad's brother example, I mean, you could resurrect him and he could be evil and that would be like, oh, that's not right. That's not how he is. And then it's like, oh, he's been, you know, there's a quest. He's been affected by being dead and you have to get him back to normal. Like, that would be a nice, interesting way to subvert expectations because you can return him to normal. But yeah, just instantly changing him isn't really the way you want to go.
Yeah, it's the same like when you, I don't know, say you retire a player character in a game and then down the line the DM introduces that character. And sometimes it's nice for the PC to play that NPC in a scene or whatever, but also sometimes if the DM has information that character should have and is pertinent to the story, you know, the DM needs to run that NPC or that PC like an NPC, right?
Mm.
But you can't just then completely change that character. You know, for instance, like Galahad, who's a paladin, he's slightly morally grey, but he's a good guy really at heart. If he said, okay, I'm going to retire him now, and then in a new campaign down the line, you bring him back, and you're like, oh, well, he's a Death Knight now.
Yeah.
he has fallen completely. I'm like, well, I don't know about that. I don't know.
All well and good if he actually had, because you told me he might have done that. But
yeah, exactly. You know. I mean, to be fair, Galahad, he could go that way. Just one bad day is all it takes, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, he is teetering the line a little bit. The other thing as well is that, you know, I always think that when we talk about this stuff, and when I listen to it back when I edit it, I always think like, oh, some of this stuff sounds like a lot of work, but what I did with that letter, it sounds like a lot of work because we're saying, you know, oh, you really knew the backstory and you got into the headspace and you wrote it from this point of view and you waited all that time and you planned it out. But really, in the grand scheme of things, it didn't take me that long because I saw the opportunity when the letter was sent. I made a note, literally made a note, to remind myself that that's the thing that had happened and that it should have a payoff. And then as I was getting close to that time, every now and then I just, each session, you know, when Cowrie had a moment or had a development, I make note of it and I'd watch the story and how it was unfolding and I think, right, when's going to be the perfect point to let it in and when's it going to fit in and what kind of twist is it going to bring, how's it going to affect him? And all that time I'm thinking, what's it going to say? What's the right thing? Because I don't want to give him a letter that's going to give him some massive existential crisis and change the character. I just want to give him a little reminder of who he once was.
Well, I did think when I got it, am I going to open this thing? Like, hey, Cowrie, so the family's dead.
Yeah.
And I'm homeless.
And I need help. Yeah, see, like, I could do that down the line because I'm not going to do that, but that's not the right way of going about it, I don't think, for the story. But you've made mention about maybe bringing him to the city sometime. So at some point, maybe you might get a cry for help from him. That could be a development because you've sort of seeded it yourself. Whereas with this one, you've kind of seeded the whole, you know, I love my brother and he's safe and he's happy. And at some point, I know it's boring there. I'm going to bring him into an exciting life and I'm going to, you know, we'll be like best buds again. And I'm like, right, okay, so he's happy, he's safe, he's living his life, but he's probably missing his brother. So let's seed that. Let's build on those emotional ties. Mm-hmm. It's really, yeah. It doesn't take as much time as you think, even though it sounds like a lot of work.
No, and I specifically wrote Kaori to be less... he's kind of an edgelord, but his backstory is not edgelordy at all.
No.
You know, he's very standard. There's no tragedy there. You know, there's always a tragedy with a player character. There's not here. He's just a guy.
Yeah.
With a couple character flaws, make him slightly interesting, and that's about it, with a normal upbringing. But that's a nice touchstone. I when I made him, I was kind of thinking about Hawkeye from... Age of Ultron, mm-hmm. and that's a bit of a twist where it turns out he's married and he's got kids and everything, and there's nothing really wrong. He's just
an agent,
an agent, a hardworking man with a happy family,
very good with a bow.
That made him so much more interesting.
Yeah.
As soon as I found that out, I was like, "Whoa, he has character!" You know, it just tells you a lot about someone. Okay, if they got kids, they got a wife or whatever.
It also
slightly stable.
Yeah, well, it also tells you that they've got something to lose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these other characters that don't have. I mean, obviously, other characters have connections. I mean, you know, by the end of Infinity War, bloody Tony's got a wife and kid. You know, so it gives something not only for him to lose, but also much more attainable for. Us as people, for example, you know, we can't ever get on the same level as Thor and understand what it's like to lose all of Asgard, but we could understand what it's like to lose a loved one,
mm-hmm.
and what weight that brings.
And it informs you so much about the character, because now when you think of Hawkeye, it gave me so much more respect for that character, because okay, he has this family. Yeah, he's got a wife, he's got kids, he's got people who depend on him, who he looks after, who he loves, and vice versa. Clearly, he doesn't need to do this job. He doesn't have to do this job, but he does it anyway, because he understands it's for a higher purpose.
Mm.
And that just informs me so much about how this character thinks, and his morals, and his beliefs, and how he acts, just based on the fact that he had this wife and kids. So... you can make a character very interesting without having some form of grief or PTSD or tragedy or whatever it may be. Those can obviously massively impact a character and inform their sort of center of being, really, but so can having positive aspects in a character's life. That's why I always find religious characters so interesting. Mm. I was watching The Last Kingdom recently, which is kind of a bit like Vikings, but a bit more historically accurate, a bit more realistic. So on Netflix at the minute. And
just shallow shade there.
Well, I actually really like Vikings, but it's just Vikings is a bit more mythical. It's a bit more fantastical, I think.
Mm.
But it's interesting because there's so many pious characters on The Last Kingdom, obviously on the Dane side with the whole... Norse pantheon, and then a lot of Christians and Christianity being represented in a large way in that show. And the characters are so interesting. Like there's a priest on that show who doesn't necessarily have anything such as a bad life. He's not tortured like a bunch of these other characters are. And he's so connected to God, but he's not infallible. He's not like a perfect being. But that aspect of faith, which is obviously a positive aspect for him as a character, informs me so much about his morals and his convictions and his beliefs. Because especially when they talk about faith a lot in that show, as you can imagine, and having faith and what that means, etc. And just having a character that can put their sort of quote-unquote faith in something, put their trust in something, whether that be God or another character or a belief or a set of ideals. Again, this is why I like Paladin so much, because there's a lot of sort of crossover there.
Mm-hmm.
Informs me so much about that character, because it's kind of a brave move. There's no evidence of anything, but you believe anyway. That's what sort of interests me a lot about religion, and then that's why I put it in my D&D game so heavily, because I just think it's interesting, especially when there is a bit of proof. You can do magic and things from the gods. It changes the dynamic and makes it just very very interesting. Ben, how did we get here, mate?
I don't know, but I'm enjoying it. I'm really enjoying it. And actually, I think your point about the when you play a game, I think we said it before, a game world where magic is real and there is a connection to the gods and there's like proof and it's not all about faith. That's such an interesting like relationship to role play. Something I've never really delved into the sort of relationship with gods and things in D&D or any RPG really, because I've always sort of seen it as a bit like, I don't really know where to go with it. I don't really know what to do with it. And I've started to a little bit with Orlo, and that's been really interesting because especially in that game world where we play in, see, this is why I like playing the Forgotten Realms with our group, because James, who is also DMing with us, he has as much of an appreciation for lore that I do. So when we work together and we put all this lore into this, or we take all the lore that exists and we, you know, rip it apart and get into it and look at it with the fine tooth comb and then build it back together and use it how we want to, we get this immense sort of lived in world that we both understand, and we can also keep interesting for the two of us, because he does bits that I don't look at and I do bits that he doesn't look at, and we play each other's games in this same world. And we started getting into some of the godly stuff, and there's so much stuff there about how to and how it all works and how they work and how they do things and why they do them a certain way. And I don't think, for me, because I don't have that kind of connection to it like you do, I don't think I would have been able to build that on my own, which I think is I'm fine admitting that. I don't mind. I'm not pride, whatever. I don't know. I think sometimes taking stuff that's already there and just ripping it apart and using it is so beneficial. But yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. I built out Orlo in the same kind of way as you as well. I looked at the character and I thought, I don't really want to do that big, oh, one day I left home forever and I'm adventuring. So I did, but I wanted something different about him, and I wanted him to have this disability, this missing arm, and I kind of built this idea around him, and then I was like, but how is he going to lose his arm if he's not had this big tragic moment? So it's just an accident. It's just an everyday accident. He lives on a farm, you know, he works with his mum and dad, and he was helping out, and one day there was an accident, he lost his arm, and now how is he a wizard? Well, you know, the only person in the village that could help was this old retired mage who could like heal the wound but couldn't, you know, grow his arm back effectively. He didn't have a cleric, and now he's not got an arm, and he's gonna go out adventuring to learn more about magic because he's interested in it, and every now and then he sends money back to his dad. So it's like, well, yeah, it's not exciting per se. It's not,
so you say that, Ben, but I know that's bullshit, and I know he's evil. Just admit that Orlo is an evil character, man.
The story, the backstory is true. That is, there is no tragic, big explosion, Michael Bay film backstory.
So he's just born a psychopath, and he's not made.
Why do you think he's a? I mean, we've been through it. You don't.
And we've been through this, but
you don't know he's a psychopath yet. Yeah.
Okay.
You think Carrie knows nothing?
No, he doesn't, to be fair. Well, he knows not a lot about it. Not a lot.
It'd be interesting if Cowrie got his hands on Orlo's journal.
That would be interesting. I mean, he probably could fairly easily do that.
Yeah.
But he respects people's privacy, Ben, okay?
Orlo's looking for a way to... He's waiting for that access to Learman's secret chest. That's what he's waiting for. Hide all his notes in there.
Well, yeah, he is a... I like spells like that, thematic. I mean, what I was going to say is that with Galahad, he was kind of my first sort of foray into exploring this gods that obviously do exist. There's no question about it. They give people magic powers, etc.
Yeah.
And but how does that work in a world where they are sometimes described as sort of benevolent and all good, yet there's a lot of suffering,
mm-hmm.
and Galahad's experienced a lot of suffering, but has constantly been told by all his mentors and teachers around him that, hey, you've got these magic powers from the gods.
Yeah.
Be good, worship them. And he's like, well, why should I worship them when they just want to make me suffer all the time? I don't want these powers. And I think that it's pretty tricky to actually justify a all good, all benevolent God in a D&D world.
Mm.
That's difficult, I think. Speaking of someone who's not really, well, who's quite a lamest when it comes to faith and religion and all things like that in my IRL life. So,
I always find that interesting about you, because you find all of the religion stuff so interesting anyway.
But I'm not actually religious, so I feel like I don't have, say, first-hand experience
yeah.
in anything like that, so I can't really...
Do you think that's why you find it so interesting?
I don't know, Ben. I don't know how my brain works.
I mean, we're beyond D&D now. We're just talking about, like, human psychology at this point, but...
Yeah, but I don't know. I just find it interesting because... And it just fascinates me in the context of Dungeons & Dragons when you've got so many different variations and permeable states of play, and everything's just interacting with each other. When you throw this very esoteric kind of idea into the mix of faith and religion and things, how does that work in the context of this world? And for, I think, Galahad, his journey is coming to understand that I think where he's at the moment is that, look, it's either all fated, everything's supposed to happen as it happened, which is an idea he's not happy about.
Yeah,
that's not very satisfying to him. He doesn't like the idea that it's all fated. What does that mean for him?
Yeah.
He either the gods just don't care, they are all powerful, they gave him these powers as almost like a joke, like, here's these powers, you still can't save the ones you love,
off you go, so, have fun. Yeah,
you know, now you just feel even more responsible because you could have done something, but we didn't quite make it so you could. You just feel like you could have, and that's it. Enjoy this torture. Which is how he's felt for the longest time, and that's made him very bitter and angry.
Mm.
And then he had a bit of a slight conversation of such with a god or a dream or whatever you want to call it, where they gave him somewhat of a direction, which I think as a player I interpreted and then misinterpreted on the behalf of Galahad, because I think that's how he would have interpreted it, and I think that just gave him more justification for his rage and anger.
Yeah,
I think now he's slowly, I mean, he's just, you know, killed a dragon, and the stakes are just raising and ever so higher and higher and higher, that the world is
literally falling apart around him.
He's beginning to see things beyond himself a little bit and having a bit of growth. And I think that where he'll either go one or two ways. I think he'll come to accept and have faith in the fact that these gods are giving him these powers and these challenges and this suffering as a test. They're not all powerful, and that they can't save everyone and make everything great. And if they did and there was no suffering, then there would be no growth for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose you can't be good, or there can't be any goodness in the world if there's no capacity for evil. If you can't physically be evil, then you can't also be good.
Yeah,
because it's a choice, and if that agency to make that choice is taken away from you, then you're just stagnant, there's no development. And so I think that if he comes to realize that this is the challenge laid down before him, the onus is on him now. He's been equipped with the tools, the powers to effect great change, to then find that sort of path of meaning, I suppose, and go down that. I think that's one direction, or it just all gets too much for him. He can't handle that responsibility, or he gives in to his more base immediate satisfaction desires,
mm-hmm.
of his vengeance and everything, and then he does just fall.
Yeah,
becomes a fallen paladin. Like, I really feel like it could go either way, and I don't know how it will go. It depends on the story, I suppose, and what challenges are thrown up in front of him. But
it's interesting, really, because like I know some of the twists and turns that are coming his way, and I don't know when, like, I know kind of when they're going to come, but I don't know where he's going to be in himself when they do, when those twists reveal themselves. And that could completely change everything. That could change the whole arc of his story. So it's fun to, and I think this is just why I like D&D, because even though in a way I'm kind of the writer of the story, because I'm sat in the chair knowing kind of where it's going, I don't really know where it's going to go and what ending it's going to be in, because it really depends on what these characters do, and I have no control over them. I think that's why, I think that's just the magic of it, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. And I think that, I just love this character so much, because it's a vessel through where I explore my own ideas and things.
Yeah.
I think that's what's great about D&D, is you can just throw things out there and see what resonates with you and other people, and explore things in a basically no consequence setting of a tabletop game. And that's something that's quite empowering to me, I think. And for Galahad especially, he's interesting because, he can go down these two different paths, and he is a vengeance paladin. He does skirt the line. I really like the more standard devotion paladin type of thing, who has these really strict oaths, and he's generally basically the Superman of paladins. Right, and that belief system, I think that is really interesting, and you can do a lot with it. I like the vengeance paladin archetype, I think, a little bit more, because it allows him to wade round in these more murky grey waters a little more. Mm-hmm. And I think that's even more dangerous, because it kind of reminds me of Jedi in a way in Star Wars, especially like prequels Jedi, who are very much the devotion type paladins. You know, they don't go anywhere near the dark side. Stay away from the dark side. Don't even look at the dark side, or you will fall. Terrible things will happen. And that kind of becomes their downfall in a way, because they're so sheltered from that then any slight hint of exposure at all just completely corrupts them. It's like it's like they've got no kind of resistance to it at all. They're not built up any immunity to this.
Right, we're getting back to the disease stuff now, are we?
Well, I think it's an interesting parallel. It's like I think if you're slightly exposed to that, to the grey areas of life, like the vengeance paladin is, they have to wade around in those murky waters.
They can see what's truly evil and what's...
Even though it's a more morally dangerous place to be, and it's very easy to teeter over into doing something abhorrent, they have such a greater understanding of the meaning of sort of life and death and punishment and justice and the whole spectrum, as opposed to this very black and white response to things, that they are able to see the darkness, you know, toy with it a little bit. Like I say, I think the vengeance paladins have much more capacity for evil than, say, the devotion paladins do. But because they have so much capacity for that they then have the agency to have much more capacity for good as well. Mm. Because they're confronted with the decision of being quote-unquote good or bad every day, and wading around in that murky area, that because they choose good every day, that makes them almost more morally justified than, say, a paladin who doesn't make that decision every day, because they're so far over to one side.
Yeah.
I don't know, that's just how I sort of see it in my head, or how I'm exploring it at the moment.
No, yeah, I get where you're coming from, and it's interesting, because I'm sort of walking that line with Orlo quite tightly. This is the thing. So I said to James, like, look, here's this character who... And at one point, I had to change his alignment. So I said to him, look, I've been thinking about it. I think, you know, some stuff's happened. I don't think I got it right with his alignment. I'm going to change it to this. And he was like, okay, fine. And, you know, the way I see him, he's so focused on this acquisition of knowledge. Knowledge is power. And he wants to be remembered. He wants to be known as the greatest. But he doesn't really have a purpose. He doesn't have a goal or a mission.
You know, if in a way, like, he wants to be you know, he wants to sort of attain the rank of master, you know, like a...
Yeah, like kind of, yeah,
like
kind
like
of.
It's like a certain,
I suppose,
misguided
you could idea. You could make that comparison. But, like, if you look at powerful wizards in D&D, if you look at people like Mordenkainen, it's like, okay, he's very powerful, he's remembered, and he has a purpose. His whole thing is that he's you've got to keep the balance of the planes and the multiverse and whatever world theory you want to call it. So Orlo is very much like, I want to be remembered like that. I want to be known as one of the best, one of the greatest. But he hasn't got that purpose. So he's kind of just going. He's just there and he's moving. And he finds, whenever he finds a bit of information, he's like, oh, this is interesting. I'm gonna look into it, regardless of what it is. And he doesn't always know what he's looking into. So he might find something really, really good and be like, I'm gonna look into it. Oh, that's nice. I'll have that. He might find something really, really dark and go, oh, what's this? I'm gonna look into it. Oh, it's really evil. Well, I'll have it, but I won't ever use it, because if I have it, I'm more powerful because I know it. But it's that idea that every time he comes a little bit close with the potential of finding something really, really amazingly powerful, but it's evil, he might just go, oh, yeah, but it's worth it, isn't it? And it's and my whole thing is, will he fall, or will he just walk this line the whole way?
That's what I think is interesting, because, again, going back to what we were saying earlier about having the capacity to do good or bad, these more powerful characters almost become more trustworthy if they are good, in a way, because you know they have so much capacity and power to do quote-unquote bad things. You know, like, if you take someone who is seemingly good, but they have no power, no strength, they're ineffectual in all way, like, how do you know that if they did have some graft, influence or power, that they would be good? Maybe they just come up here that way because they don't have any opportunity to be bad, really, on a grand scheme, you know? Whereas these, like, so that's why I find really powerful wizards very interesting. And I find they generally, in this sort of fiction, go one or two ways. Either, well, three ways, really. They become very evil, become a lich, whatever, right? They sort of, they lose their humanity and power corrupts them. They either become really powerful and really good because, and those are supremely good characters. Like, I would say, like, Mordenkainen and people like that, even though they've done dubious things, they are ultimately good characters because they have so much power and could affect so much change, but they utilize it for the greater good, right? And then I find the ones who go this way is that they just become apathetic, right?
Yeah.
That all those quarrels of good and bad or whatever, they essentially just lose all semblance of a moral compass or humanity, right? And then they're searching for some sort of higher purpose at that point. And then if they do bad things, they do good things, it's irrelevant to them. They don't even see it as that anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could see Orlo going that way, where he's like, well, it doesn't really matter anymore. I'm just trying to live forever.
Yeah, <You know? laughs> effectively. And I think the thing with, like, and you've got to remember, like, Mordenkainen is a bit of a dick. And, like, most wizards who go on that, you know, I'm doing things for the greater good, they end up being arseholes because they're like, well, you don't understand the complexity and the mission that I'm on, and I'm gonna do this for the greater good, and, oh, you know, it's the trolley problem. Do I let four people get hit by the trolley or one person? Well, I'm gonna sacrifice the one person for the greater good. Even though they're good people, they become quite, I think, or the way I see it, quite morally grey. I mean, there are a few standouts who are still very good. I mean, there are wizards in the lore of D&D that are, you know, at least outwardly very good and grateful people, and people love them and appreciate them. And then there are good wizards like Mordenkainen who will play people off on each other to make sure that, you know, the good thing happens. But it's like, is it the good thing? Can we, like, you know, one of the whole things in the Tome of Foes is about the Blood War, and how if one side of the Blood War won, then it would completely throw everything off kilter. But you know, normal people might say, well, surely it's a good thing for a war between demons and devils to stop, because that's chaotic and sometimes it spills over into our world. But he would say, well, no, sometimes a city's going to have to fall to the demons so that they can have enough troops to stop the wave of devils, because otherwise the war's going to end and it's going to be complete chaos. So it's,
yeah, and it's
weird.
It's like, it's, and again, like a, perhaps a devotion paladin would be inhibited from making that type of decision. Whereas again, like a, someone who has more leeway to see the grander picture can make those morally gray, difficult choices with the long game, but then it becomes, you know, sacrifice a few to save the many. When at what point does that teeter into unjustifiable behavior? I think that's pretty interesting, and those characters, like you say, become interesting as they become more powerful. That's why I find high level campaigns quite interesting, because player characters have so much power to affect change in the world. At that point, it's like, how are you going to wield it?
Yeah.
What are you going to do with these sort of immense gifts, right? Like, I think Game of Thrones is a pretty good example, because you have Jon Snow, he joins the Wall. He seems like a seemingly good character. He's got a lot of angst or whatever, but he's got, seems like at his heart, a pretty good guy. But he has no power, so you don't really know for sure what he will do with it when he gets it. Whereas you say, like, compare Joffrey, right, who has all the power in the world, and then we can see what he does with that power, and it only enhances his negative traits. Whereas then Jon becomes, you know, spoiler alerts from Game of Thrones, you know, he becomes the commander of the Night's Watch, and then what does he do with that? He utilizes it to save lives.
I mean, he gets stabbed a few thousand times.
Yeah, you know, he gets punished for his good acts, but that's what he does, and that's what, why we connect with him on such a visceral level. A level, and then whereas you can, well, Daenerys is interesting, because she pretty much does mostly good stuff, but she she's a harsh punisher, you know, with fire and blood. And so you always wonder, can she teeter or not? And then obviously, evidently, she does teeter over to darkness in the end, very abruptly.
Yeah, let's not get into that.
You know, that it wasn't done great, but the idea was sound.
Yeah.
That, okay, you could see the through line, because even from day one, she's been cold and vicious because of, you know, the events that have shaped and molded her. She's had to adapt to this really a much harsher environment that John's been in, and she's not had the perhaps as sound mentorship that he's had, and guidance by good people. She's just been in really tough situation after tough situation, and so that then makes her, well, it just makes her more susceptible to that darkness, I suppose. That's what makes her interesting. I find it interesting about, like, Xanathar as well, who's come up a lot in our game.
Yeah.
Who obviously is this maniacal beholder. But beholders are interesting in that, you know, they see all other forms of life form as lesser than they are.
Yeah.
Sort of, if they... subhuman in a way. Obviously they're not human, sub-beholder, right?
Yeah, they're all lesser to some extent.
Yeah, and it's an interesting philosophical point, because then it's like, okay, so he vaporizes people all the time and he's very evil, does all these dastardly acts, but is he evil if he can't even comprehend that these other people are people and have thoughts and feelings and emotions, right? Is the, I don't know, the crocodile evil for eating the antelope, right?
I mean,
well, you know, I would say no. It's it doesn't even comprehend that antelope might feel anything or whatever. It's just thinking about its next meal. Xanathar's just thinking about, well, it's difficult to even say, because that's why I find aberrations so interesting, because they're just unknown evils,
yeah,
right? You don't even know. They don't even see people as people. This is what makes, like, Cthulhu and Starspawn and all that stuff we spoke about before, sort of this occult stuff, really scary, because they have no concept of good or bad, which is even more, like, I would rather have an evil I know than someone who knows no evil at all. That's horrifying.
I get where you're coming from. I think the difference with beholders, though, is that, like, I mean, the thing with beholders is that they are more than just like an unexplained creature. They have these almost human traits to them, or you know, humans are not really the right word for it, because there are other races in D&D, but you kind of understand where we're coming from when we say that. beholders have some form of deity. Whether it's actually a deity or not is kind of questionable, but they have this creature, this ultimate beholder that they see above all as the one true god of them. God would not be the right word for them. They are not. They're aberrations. They don't believe in the same way as we would. And each beholder, and this is why I find them so interesting, each beholder thinks that they are the perfect clone, the perfect copy, the exact image of that true perfectionist icon. So when they see another beholder who inevitably looks different to them, it's like, well, you are not the true image of our one great creature, and therefore you are lesser than I because I am the great image. So then they see everything else in the same way. So it's less of like, oh, you are not as worthy as me. Well, I mean, it is, you're not as worthy, but it's less like, oh, you're lesser than me because I don't like you. They literally believe that everything else isn't the depiction of perfection. And because that's so ingrained into them, it's almost like, well, can you blame them? And maybe for that, maybe not. Maybe if that's something they cannot help, then sure. This is weird that we're trying to defend a beholder's ways, but whatever. But when you look at what the Sanath has done, which isn't unheard of, beholders do tend to take other beings and use them because, yeah, you might not be, you know, you're not as perfect or as right as me. You are a lesser being, but you're still useful
to me.
But
you've got thumbs, and yeah. I need people with thumbs to carry things.
My teleportation ray eye is unfortunately needing a contact lens, so you're gonna have to do stuff for me. But the stuff he has done is kind of like, I mean, he runs basically a terrorist group in a way, and he just causes chaos, and, you know, he just kills people because he wants to, because it's fun. He runs a gladiatorial ring because it brings him joy to watch people fight to the death. Like, that stuff, yeah, okay, maybe we can't forgive him for that.
No, Xanath is, I think, is perhaps, yeah, as you're saying,
he is a bit different. Yeah,
he's a bit different because he obviously, beholders have it a lot of intelligence like other creatures, and so they have the capacity to understand consciousness. I suppose, like the alligator, this is where sort of the alligator analogy falls apart, because they understand the consciousness of other people and the pain of other people, but yet they sort of inflict this horrid pain and suffering anyway. I mean, they're kind of basically just Nazis in a way, right? If they're seeking this sort of perfected form, right? Mm-hmm. And then anything that is not this perfected form is not worth keeping around. Sounds very Nazi-ish to me.
Yeah, I mean, literally the word in the Monster Manual, like one of the subheadings for them is like xenophobic something. I can't remember how they describe them, but they are literally xenophobes.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, did it throw you off guard when my character decided his life goal was to kill Xanath? Is that...
No, I kind of thought you would want to get to the head of the Xanathar's Guild. Killing the Xanathar is a big thing, and it's... I've seen a lot of comments about...
This is what I'm asking. Is his stat blocked out?
He is not statted out separately. It tells you to use a beholder stat block, and then it gives you a list of changes to make. Because he has some differences, and being who he is, he has access to items and things as well.
I presume that makes him tougher than a standard beholder.
Yes. Also, the fact that he would be in his lair makes him tougher as well. It's hard to say because really it doesn't give you a CR for him as well.
I've no idea how it's actually going to be pulled off, because a straight fight's not going to work.
No, I have no idea either. It will be interesting to see what you do, but you've got to remember as well that Dragon Heist is a 1-5 adventure, and it actually says in there, you know, your players aren't meant to fight these villains. And I always knew that going in at level 5, that was going to be potentially achievable at some point and an option, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah, but players read that and you're like, not meant to.
Doesn't mean we can't.
Doesn't mean there's a chance.
Yeah, exactly. But like, he, what I need to work out, the stuff that will be fun for me is like, what happens if the head of this criminal organization goes away? And like, there's a reason that, you know, the Open Lord and the Black Staff haven't fronted an assault to the Xanathar Guild, because even though he is this evil corporation, you know, that's doing bad things, and there is a gang war going on, he also does offer something to the city, because he kind of regulates and controls the criminal population. So it's like, well, that's helpful to us. The rest of the stuff, not so much. So what happens if that figurehead goes away? Because the whole Xanathar Guild is like, I'll stab you in the back to get to the top. But it's like, what do you do once you're at the top? Because you're never going to get
it's like 1980s Yakuza and Japanese police, where they don't really chase them down. As long as they're just killing each other. Yeah, when people start dropping in the streets or step in, but until, as long as they're killing each other behind closed doors.
Yeah, well, that's why there's now a problem that there's all this gang war on the streets. But the other thing as well is, like, the Xanathar, like, Xanathar is a title. It's not a name. And there have been many Xanathars. They have all been beholders because of the way beholders kind of recreate and populate. And I'm not going to go into it. It's complicated. But what would be interesting is, And if what I think Kaori's plan is to become the Xanathar, effectively, is if...
Well, he's thinking about it, but I don't think he's as bold to say that he's qualified for that job just yet.
Yeah, fair.
But potentially.
But what would be interesting in that scenario is, even if it wasn't Kaori, if someone took over that position, a lot of the fear that comes from the Xanathar is that certain people know what he is. Most people don't, but, you know, certain people do. And that kind of... that mystery and that fear from other people, and it's usually bigger mob bosses. It's kind of like, you know, if you were the big boss of the mob, and then all of the other bosses were scared of you, everyone else wouldn't touch you because their bosses are scared of their boss. But the fear comes from the fact that people know he's a beholder. So what happens if that goes away? Does the person who steps in pretend to be a beholder and just never get seen and keeps that charade going? Or do they, you know, try and reform the guild, quote unquote? It'll be very interesting to find out.
Well, Kaori's plan was originally just join the Xanathar's guild. They had some information that he wanted anyway. Obviously, he wanted to find the boy. Interested in that, and he was just interested in having access, you know, to the power. And the fact that he knew that not many people see the Xanathar or know who he. At that point, he thought he was just a man. He just wanted to see him, just to say he'd done it, right? And had that access. But the more he got involved and the more morally grey things progressed, I think, and he's having a bit of a crisis of faith. He's kind of religious, but not really, I suppose, loosely. And perhaps that's growing a little bit within him at the moment. And I like his priestly character as well. I think he has a large impact on his...
the guy in his backstory.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see Kaori as more spiritual than religious at the moment. You know, he's got kind of these... I kind of get the feeling that he thinks there's... You know, there is a greater plan and there is a flow to it all, but he doesn't believe in the greater higher being that controls everything. Which would be interesting to see if he ever went that way. I don't know. It'd be fun to see.
I think, I like to tie in the fact that even though he's this kind of city boy and he has this love-hate relationship with society and government, he loves to be in this urban environment, but he also hates the kind of civility of it all.
Yeah.
But on top of that, he is a wood elf, and he's come from a rural area, and he is naturally this... more naturalistic, like you say, spiritual guy, right? And he's been brought up with these beliefs, and he takes heed, because even though he doesn't like his dad very much and he doesn't respect him very much, he does respect the fact that his dad is a wood elf who's like hundreds of years old and probably does know a thing or two, right? And when he teaches him about their culture and their ancestry and things like that, he does take heed to that. That's why he was quite adamant about not disturbing that elven grave.
Yeah.
Because there is some stuff that he holds value to. Not a lot, but some stuff. And when it came to meeting Abraham, this priest, I think he listens to Abraham less because he's a godly man and a priest, but just because he knows he's a good man. And so he knows he's a good barometer for... for morals and for guidance, right? And I think that, and Abraham knows that Carys is not necessarily a godly man, so he doesn't preach to him. I think he tactfully preaches to him without him really knowing.
Well,
right?
Abraham is a follower of Gond, who is all about invention and creation. So he's got all of these like fun little knickknacks and creations and things that he's made, and I like that. I picked that for him because Carys is quite hands-on. He's quite a bit of a tinkerer himself. He makes all these little things, and I like to think that that exposure has brought that out in him, and that's the way that Abraham sort of delivers his religion on to Cowrie. It's like, yeah, you know, create things and present them to the world, and you're making it a brighter place and a better place.
Yeah,
but then Cowrie makes things that shoot glass into people's eyes, so
well you got part of the message. I just like him because, and again, like that priestly character, he's not infallible. You know, he likes a drink every now and then.
Oh, yeah.
Gets a bit leery.
A drink under the table, mate.
So he's a... I think what's nice is Carys sees a lot of these priestly figures and stuff as high and mighty, but Abraham comes down to his level, you know, and they talk as equals, which I think is pretty good for him.
Just going back to the Xanathar really quickly as well, I realised yesterday when we were going through it all that you know, there is no way that I cannot let killing the Xanathar and becoming the head of the Xanathar's guild be unattainable, because I play in a game where my character has become a Duke of Baldur's Gate, so I'd be a bit of a hypocrite if I made that inaccessible. So I'll tell you now, it is possible.
I'm just thinking about
it's gonna be bloody difficult, mate. I mean, it is almost a suicide mission.
Well, I'm just thinking because, well, Carys, up until like 20 minutes before the session ended or whatever, was like, oh, you know, I'm gonna go up to the man and I'm gonna slit his throat. And so he doesn't really know where the throat is on a
beholders don't have a throat. Okay.
So he's got, but we got a team. We're researching them. We got to figure it out. Maybe he'll enlist the help of like dragon or something. He's got a bit of an acute fear of dragons.
How are you going to get a dragon into a city that is warded from dragons?
Well, man, we'll have to turn that ward off, won't we? Mm. You know, we know the Black Staff. We're good friends with the Black Staff.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way, but okay.
I'm sure she can figure it out.
You should ask her about that. That'd be interesting. It'd be fun.
Well, there's that. The only other plan, obviously, Carys' player notes is like we get him to dream up, we're going to get him so paranoid he dreams up another beholder and fight each other till like that, and then when that one of them kills the other, hopefully they'll be so near death anyway we can just go in for the killing blow.
That's going to be so hard to orchestrate.
I know, yeah.
What's
know.
Fun as well is in the Waterdeep book, you've got in the Xanathar section, it says like, you know, players probably won't be able to kill him because, you know, max level is 5, but here's some ways they could disrupt his guild, or here's how they could really upset him. So there's like some fun, interesting things that you could do. You've got to find out what they are, but the thing is,
obviously we've not necessarily really met the main villain of this campaign or main villains as such. Well, but like we've not really interacted with them on a...
Not on a one-to-one level.
No.
Well, actually...
After the last session, maybe a little bit. But I don't even really know who the main villains are. That's the thing.
That's the beauty of it.
And it's such a heavily modified adventure that I don't... You know, it's hard to gauge what's going on. But I think we have to maybe enlist the help of some of them to get it done. I'm not really sure.
That could be very interesting.
Like, could I blind the beholder with the old glass blaster, just the pulverized glass in the eyes? Presumably.
Yeah, I mean, he has 10 of them, so...
I mean, yeah, it'd be tricky to blind him, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, you could take out maybe one of his eyes.
That would be a lot of eyes to blind.
It's a lot of pulverized glass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting. The party weren't on board.
No. They really weren't, and there was a moment where we had this, basically had an intervention for you, and there was a lot of arguing, and we had a break afterwards, and we came back, and one of the players, I think Phoebe, she went, I need to say sorry because I feel like we've had an argument. And I was like, do you know what? Maybe this is why we all get on as friends, because we just vent our problems with each other through our characters.
I know. I just told her to shut up and be quiet. And
you,
like,
you did, yeah.
I don't know if it came off a bit harsh.
Yeah, I did think that. I was like, down, oh dear. This is the thing. I always hear people say, and I always used to hear it before we played, was like, oh, you know, I don't know what my character's going to do. I'm like, how do you not know what your character's going to do? You're playing them. But sometimes I really don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah, well, you just get into it. And I think everyone's kind of very method, aren't they? As soon as we start playing, no one really breaks character very much, other than for the odd joke. So it's like we are in it. Yeah, we're just in it at that point. So
yeah, for like 7 hours.
We get really, really invested. And everyone's got such great characterization that it's so easy to just slip into that role again. You don't feel silly in any way. And everyone does, I say everyone, basically only me, well, two of us do silly voices as well, so that's kind of fun.
Yeah, you know? And I do voices all the time because I'm bloody everybody, aren't I? So
I don't know how we got here, Ben, but it's been an interesting talk.
It's been quite fun. I do like these, and we do get messages saying that people enjoy listening to us talk about this stuff, because it's just, you know, an unscripted chat, and there are tidbits of like interesting things that you can take away from it. So I don't know. It's been a fun hour though.
Yeah, no, I'd be interested. I mean, because obviously we get a lot of people writing. I'd be interested if anyone who is sort of very religious in their IRL actual life, if they integrate that at all into their games, or they don't, and it's more just a kind of form of escapism from their real life. Or I'd be interested to see how, from the perspective of someone who is religious, if our chat resonates with them at all, if they're horribly offended by it, you know, I'd just be interested to see what
people
say about it. Well, Ben, you can't please everyone, can you?
I never want to offend anyone, though. It's just only a fun game. It's a fun hobby, after all.
You offend me every day.
Oh,
every
okay. Day. Well, all right, fine. Wonderful. Do you know what? We should... what's fun, what's interesting... is that with this shared world universe, with James and I both running games in the same universe, is that we've got an opportunity now where some of the players are going to go away as some of their characters and some new characters to go on a separate little adventure. It's like a little break, and then they're going to come back and we're going to swap DMs for a little bit. But it's the same universe, same world, same characters. So it would be interesting, after we've done that and we've come back to Waterdeep, and we've seen some of those more connected swaps happen in game, because they've been happening all the time, and we've mentioned little bits where you said like, oh, I don't know, you know, suddenly James starts talking and I don't know what's going on. But there'll be a lot more of that in the next couple of sessions, so it'll be interesting to get James on after that's happened and have a sort of conversation as the two DMs and a player, and see what people think about running a shared universe, you know, with different DMs would be like, because I've really enjoyed it. What's your opinion?
I like it. I mean, like I said, I've not experienced it much, because the campaigns that I've been in with each DM have been, you know, relatively separate. But the little moments of crossover have been fun. I think if we go on this little Baldur's Gate adventure, I will probably not benefit from it as much as, say, you will, because you're in both campaigns. Yeah. And obviously, I know James has picked Baldur's Gate because he's obviously fleshed out that whole area very well.
He's so got stuff he hasn't used there, yeah.
So you'll probably be going, oh, whoa, oh, that. And I'll be like, what?
Yeah, it's like,
I have no context.
Wesley, he's another player, he plays in the Baldur's Gate game, and he is in Avernus with my character. And when they left Baldur's Gate, the election was happening, and my guy had put his name in, and he'd done a lot of work to ensure he had a lot of backing, but then he went down into Avernus and doesn't know the result. So when Orlo found out, he literally, James told me through an NPC so the quest is that Orlo's got to go to Baldur's Gate and investigate one of the dukes who has been missing but is still giving orders. And the NPC literally said, so in Baldur's Gate there's four dukes, one of them is holding down the fort, two of them are in hell, and the other one is missing. And I was like, wait, hang on, how many of them are in hell? So when Orlo got to basically explain why he was leaving, and he said that to the group, Wesley gave me this look like, sorry, what? And I was like, yeah. Because Wesley's character in Baldur's Gate hates mine. So, typical. So that's it's a lot of fun. It is a lot of fun.
There you go. Just make your player characters politicians. What can go wrong?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, art imitates life. So, who knows? But yeah, we'll get him on and we'll have a good chat, because I did say to him a long time ago it might be something we want to talk about, and he was all up for it. So
cool. Well, this has been a good one.
It has been a good one, and you said it wasn't going to be a good one at the start.
Wow, they're always good ones, Ben. Yeah. But I like to set the expectations low so we can then raise them throughout the show.
Yeah, right. I always say if you go in with no expectations, you come out thoroughly pleased. So, well, look, you can get in touch with us at WeSpeakCommon on Twitter. You can email us, WeSpeakCommon@hotmail.com. Our website is WeSpeakCommon.com. And if you see us on Reddit, it's usually me. Also, fun thing, Joe, because this episode is out, if you're listening to it, on the Thursday that it release, on Thursday, the 28th, which means... in 3 days' time, we'll have a pretty big announcement happening on our Twitter.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So if you aren't following us, get over there to be the first to know, and we will then do a re-announcement in next week's episode, I suppose.
Yeah. And if you're, you know, you're wondering what it may be, what it might be, just look back at, you know, stuff we've done in the past. Mm. It might be a bit of a giveaway as to what we're doing going forward. Too much.
No, I think that's slightly undersells it, but okay. Anyway, we'll see you next week. If we don't see you on Twitter, have a great rest of your day, whatever you're doing. I don't know.
Bye-bye.
See you later. Thanks for listening today. If you like the podcast, do us a favour. Leave us a like or review on your platform of choice and share us with your friends. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at WeSpeakCommon or through the email WeSpeakCommon@hotmail.com. The music in the podcast is Street Dancing by Timecrawler82 and is licensed under an attribution license CC by NC. You can find it on the Free Music Archive.